Hey, it's Alan, and I just wanted to let you know that you can now listen to the ongoing history of New Music early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
If you're going to commit to being in a band, you have to be prepared to deal with the bad as well as the good. The good stuff can include fame, money, perks, and the ability to make a living by playing music. It's enviable stuff. But then there's the bad side of things. Problems with your record label, lineup changes, dealing with the fickle tastes of the public, writer's block, internal struggles, management hassles, and I guess we can add pandemic lockdowns too. I could go on, but I think you get the point. These are things that can be deadly for any group, at any level, at any time. But none of these issues are necessarily fatal. And this is where I direct you to Exhibit A, Canada's 5440. This band has been a going concern since 1980. And while there have been a couple of lineup changes over the years, three by my count, the core of the group is still there. Here's singer Neil Osborne and guitarist Brad Merritt.
Well, there's just two things that we say, or one thing I say, one thing Brad says. So I'll do my one, which is we started out, like I said, we were on a mission. We were going to change the world. We were like revolutionaries, you know, like The Clash and Sandinista and all that. So I was like, if I'm still doing this when I'm 30, I'm going to shoot myself. So then, you know, hits started to come along, success. Like, I'm still doing this when I'm 40, shoot me. And then it's like, if I'm still doing this when I'm 50, hey man, this is like amazing. And now I'm 60 and it's like, oh my God, I can't believe I get to do this. And then Brad has we have a final, our 20 year out. You can
go. Oh, that one. Yeah. So, we do these radio interviews and, you know, the person who's doing the interview with me is like, how much longer are you going to do this? And I kind of took umbrage at that. So I actually thought about it for a minute and I went, well, when the Rolling Stones quit, that's our 20-year warning.
Because we started 20 years after they started. Just keep creating, keep writing. You know, if you love it, do it. And then maybe something will happen. Maybe it won't, but at least you'll be doing what you love. And, you know, everything should take care of itself.
This is the story of 5440 in their own words, part two.
This is the Ongoing History of New Music podcast with Alan Cross.
"5440" and "Love You All" from their 1996 album Trusted by Millions, the group's third consecutive platinum record. Hello again, I'm Alan Cross, and this is the second half of a sit-down with 5440. Neil Osborne, Brad Merritt, Matt Johnson, and David Genn. I let them take care of the storytelling this time. We ended part one in about 1995 with the band releasing their sixth record, Smiling Buddha Cabaret. But we have to backtrack a little bit before we go forward. They had to switch labels. They were dropped by Warner, but picked up by Sony Music Canada. So let's start there.
So what does one do when they lose their big American record deal and are unsure of their future? So how did you guys even hold it together?
Yeah, another existential moment. Another moment where you could pack it in or decide you're going to go on. So I like, you know, what Neil was talking about with Fight for Love. It's like, you know, at that point when we wanted to retrench and you know, success is not guaranteed by taking the record company's path, right? So you don't know, the future's unwritten. So why not succeed or fail on your own terms rather than somebody else's terms? And so that was our attitude from that point on. We felt a little, not embittered, I didn't, but it was a learning experience doing that Show Me record, right? Because we sort of went with the path of least resistance. You guys know, the producer, the people at the record company, and we didn't like it. That's the only record that we made that I can't even listen to anymore. I literally cannot listen to that record. So I said, well, we're just going to stick together as a band and not listen to these people anymore. I mean, we'll listen, but we're going to do our own thing. And so now we're into the transition. We got a kind of like a couple of years where we're going to figure some things out and try to get another deal because we don't want to make independent records. And there's deals out there. And, you know, we're courting record companies, they're courting us, and we're spending lots of time writing. Sure, we must have had 30 or 40 songs.
Yeah, about 30 songs for the Dear Dear record. Yeah, and it was a long time. It was a year or two, right? Without knowing what was going to happen. Yeah. Meanwhile, we were getting gigs in Canada mostly.
And there was that Greatest Hits album dropped in the middle there.
Yes. Warner Canada did that. Which did really well. Sold bucket loads.
Yeah.
Well, I think that Greatest Hits record actually sort of reset the band with the Canadian audience, because it gave Much Music something more to talk about and more to play.
Yeah.
And I mean, a Greatest Hits record is mailbox cash, right? It's one of those things that you didn't have to put anything into.
Yeah.
Yet pays off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that you're right. It did sort of consolidate the reputation of the band a little bit. And then Sony, you know, started to grow as a company. We called it Celine Bucks, you know, and Paul Berger was brought in to run the company, and he was eager to find stuff. And somebody mentioned us to him and Richard Zuckerman, who was his A&R guy. And then bing, bada bing, bada boom, all of a sudden we're making a record for those guys.
By this time, there was no American record contract. But then fate intervened in a very weird way. An American band had blown up with their first album, and they decided to cover an old 5440 song.
So this would be a good time to revisit I Go Blind.
Okay.
Because that has to be... It's almost like the Bare Naked Ladies recording the theme for Big Bang Theory.
No, I wish it was.
It wasn't? So explain how this comes along. I mean, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish was a band that nobody knew anything about, and they picked one of your songs.
They, as Brad and I like to tell it, I guess, we would play this club in Washington, D.C. called the 930 Club back on the Green Record and Show Me. And they came up from University of South Carolina, and they were fans. And they played almost every song off the Green Record in their cover band. And every REM song that their two favorite bands were REM and 5440, oddly. And then we're actually out on the road starving in like 96, 97 or whatever it was. And I get a phone call from my management, Jason Grant. And he's like, I Go Blind is a B-side on Hootie and the Blowfish cassette. I'm like, who's Hootie and the Blowfish? And it's like, they're taking off right now. So I go to a record store and actually buy the cassette single to see that, oh, yeah, there it is. That's so cool. I'm thinking nothing of it, right? And then it takes off not long after.
Well, it ends up with a Friends soundtrack, right?
Yeah. So once again, as we understand it, the A&R guy who put together the Friends soundtrack moved from Atlantic to wherever, or one of the labels, and was in charge of putting together the Friends soundtrack. But he's also the guy that had signed Hootie, you know, to their label. So he asked them for a song. They're in between records. So they had recorded I Go Blind. It didn't make their first record. It was cut. But they said, you can have this song, but just promise us you won't release it as a single for the Friends soundtrack. And they went, okay, no problem. So I think Bare Naked Ladies was one of the singles that came out on the Friends sound, like delivered. Can't remember who else, but radio out of Boulder or Denver somewhere just because the Hootie was like all the rage, right? It was sort of the anti Nirvana, and people started requesting it. They started to play it, and then it just sort of built out naturally, just like the old school when a DJ would play a song and fans would like it. And then request it, and the DJ in the next city would pick up on that, and it would just, instead of pre-planned like it is today, it was a really neat, organic thing. So
that must have been really fun to watch.
They tried to stop it. I mean, their new record just been released, and they basically told radio, look, shut that song down. Here's our new single. They released that single, and it pretty well died. And radio just went, "Nope, okay, we'll go back to I Go Blind."
Well, here's the thing that a lot of people don't realize is that if you are an American artist on American radio and you're playing a cover, you don't reap any radio airplay royalties from that, because it only goes to the composers. So
and no publishers.
And the publishers. So they had nothing and would only benefit from the mechanical royalties, which would be the sale of the Friends record or that cassette single.
Yeah. Yeah. And when Matt's talking about the record company here, he's not talking about the band. The band were very, very happy for us. They say we did some tour with them. They wanted us to play with them, and we did. And I remember them, Sony, the drummer, what was his name? Sony, what was came in with the Billboard. It was number 3 on Hot AC or whatever the heck it was. And he goes, "You guys are going to get some money. You know, this is great. Da, 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 da. Make sure you get every penny." You know, so they were very happy for us that had happened. So it's got nothing to do with them. They were actually quite thrilled.
And that must have been some pretty good mailbox money for a number of years.
I remember my wife calling me, because she used to get the checks in the mail. They made a mistake. We got to give it back. Because there's so many zeros on that first check. She was in shock. Like, what do we do? We got to go to the bank and tell them it's not right. You know, and it was right.
The original. Back with more 5440 in their own words in just a sec. This is part 2 of 5440 in their own words. Neil, Brad, Matt, and David all took part in this chat in the basement of the Horseshoe Tavern in Toronto. Let's continue, picking up things with the Since When album in 1998.
So Since When... Are we still recording in the U.S. or have we moved back to Canada?
No, Since When we had, we had Garth Richardson produce it. You know, we had a lot of common friends, and we would hang out and after shows and, you know, drink Crown Royals with him and stuff like that. And he always wanted to produce us. And we were into this phase where we wanted to do a total about face. Like, I remember our manager, Alan, going, "You know, this could be career suicide, because you go from Trusted by Millions to Since When, or it could be a license that you can do anything you want." And we chose the latter, whether the public did or not. and Brad and I had a big sit down with Garth and said, "Look, we don't want to make one of your, like, you know, testosterone, big muscle tattoo, thick neck, platinum selling beef records. We want to do..."
Yeah, we don't want to be Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah. No, well, we'd love to be Rage Against the Machine, but that's already come and gone. But, you know, Garth's got, I don't know how many platinum records, you know, he'll show you. And I've never heard any of these bands, to be quite honest, but somehow they all sold 1 million records in the States, because they go, "Arr!" We told them we wanted to do a 16-track, 2-inch, intimate record. That's really what we wanted to do, and we wanted to bring in strings and do all these things. You know, just where our artistic fancy went. And that's a very, very good sounding record. Garth is an excellent producer, and he went with it. And you know, we had the song Since When, which I think was our... Oh, I don't know. I was told our only AM single that tracked.
It might be. It might be. I can't think of too many
AM radio at the time. Yeah.
TV commercial too, didn't it?
And so that song, because it was a Telus and a Hyundai commercial and some other thing, and we recouped all of our Sony
publishing.
Yeah. You know, and when you get a publishing deal, you know, like a record deal, but a publishing deal is a little different, because you sell the rights to half of your songs. But we're, you know, being typical musicians sitting in a dressing room like this even today, "Wait a minute, you're going to give me money for my songs?" "Yeah, sure, I'll take it." Of course, then when it recoups, "Wait a minute, I'm giving you half of all my money now?" So it's double-edged sword there.
This is an odd time too. So we're what, about 98, right? And the idea of a band licensing a song to a TV commercial was still pretty risky.
Yes. So if we back up a little bit, we were totally against that. So we had a few, you know, offers. We had an offer for one of the cigarette companies to, you know, a free bus for the tour. And we turned that down, you know, the Neil Young, don't sing for Miller, don't sing for Bud kind of vibe. You know, we had in our contracts, still do actually, complete control over the visibility of the stage. We paid a big festival where we opened for Pearl Jam. Where was that? Gimli or something like that out in Manitoba. And they had a big Labatt's balloon. And we refused to go on until they deflated the balloon, right? And there was this big standoff going on. This is about 97, nine, just before Since When came out. Trusted by Millions tour anyway. And I remember, what's his face? The little guy, the singer in Eddie Vedder. Yeah. Sorry.
The little guy.
he's got a big voice, excellent voice. But when you stand next to him, the first thing you say is like Danny DeVito. God, you're short. anyhow, he was like, what's the problem? And so he hustles off with the promoters and the other members of the band. And explained, well, these guys have this thing in their contract, and you know, and he said, take it down. So thanks to him, they took it down. Now, what happened is we started to play a lot of, and we still relied a lot on university shows and Frosh Weeks and stuff like that. And we would make sure that you didn't see the beer companies or whatever. But then what happened is the front line moved, right? All of a sudden, it's because you can't see what we're talking, but you're standing there thinking you're holding the line. Next thing you know, the battle is behind you somewhere because the Molson and the cigarette companies went directly to the venues, went directly to the promoters. Where if you wanted to play at all, you had to see Molson or Bud or Labatt's or, you know, Players Light or whatever it was, or Coke. You didn't have a choice anymore. It was over. That battle, you lost the battle without even knowing it, right? It's like being one of those, you know, Japanese guys in a cave 20 years later, like, the war's over, you know? So all of a sudden it wasn't a stand we could take because there was no way to do it at all.
Once you play the Coca-Cola stage, you know? And,
yeah.
Like, you know, so what do you, you well, know? That would be right. Yeah, everybody was starting to sell naming rights.
Yeah.
So you were at the Molson Amphitheater.
You didn't get a choice. Yeah. And they weren't paying. And then what was worse, we were getting paid because before they would pay you to put the Coca-Cola sign up or, you know, take this with you and put this banner up. And we refused. Other bands would do it. And that was their choice. I don't care. But we just didn't want, that just felt like a bitter, bitter pill.
So what tipped you in the direction of licensing Since When?
Once we signed a deal with Sony, they gave us basically money for down payments for our houses for publishing. Then they would come and say, we've got this license for, you know, and Since When was sort of an AM hit and more people will get to hear it and like it. And at that time, songs, pop songs on commercials were driving. It's kind of like what TikTok is doing now. People rediscovering hit songs and stuff like that. And you just sort of had to accept once again. That's the new reality, right? If your song's in a movie or a commercial, it's gonna do you way better than you out in the club.
The title track of Since When and the band's highest charting single. Moving on, we get to 2000 and we're at the Casual Viewing record and there's the tipping point. You know, you up at that point had been participating in a traditional recorded industry situation environment where you sold pieces of plastic to the public as everybody had been doing for the last 100 years. 2000 comes. Do you remember thinking that a change is going to come or do you think that, oh, well, this is interesting, but it's never going to really affect us?
I can tell you a story that sticks with me even, you know, that's really easy to tell and explains everything. And we had done the, Matt and I had mixed with Lenny.
Yeah.
Lenny.
DeRose.
DeRose. Thanks, Dave. Dave's here. The album out at Sony when they still had the big building, right? And we, and then Rick Camilleri, who was the president at that time, came in and heard, and I remember Mike Rowe thought the Unbend was going to be the single, and he heard the song Casual Viewing. He goes, that's a single. And we kind of agreed, Matt and I thought that that was happening. Fast forward a little bit, a couple of days later, I had just seen that movie, Buena Vista Social Club, that I understood was all recorded on video cameras, okay? Not film cameras. And that's how they made it cheap. So I went, you know, because when we were doing videos, once again, it was Celine bucks everywhere, pools of money. We would do these videos for $200,000, and they'd hire some student out of Mexico City who was all the hot shit, and he'd make a stand in a cold puddle in a warehouse. And we're like, well, what the hell is this about? This is stupid. And, you know, that kind of thing. So I went in and said, you know, the song Casual Viewing is taken from a line from Brad and I are huge Genesis fans from Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. You know, Marshall McLuhan, Casual Viewing. So the theme of the song is how communication is changing the world. Kind of what you're alluding to, right? Things are changing. We're connecting more. Internet's happening, all this sort of stuff. And so I've seen Buena Vista Social Club, and I don't want to have the latest, greatest 25-year-old director that everybody's raving about in Toronto that's going to spend money for something stupid. I said, and I go into his office, and before I do my pitch, which was to basically, let's take a skeleton crew, some high-end Sony digital cameras, and go around the world to show how the world's connected. So we went to Casablanca, Bangkok, Essaouira in Morocco, and we did that video. But Rick also said, I remember he's throwing a Nerf basketball, you know, before I do the request, and he grants the request, you know, to basically let us go around the world in 3 weeks, business class, filming a video. And he goes, it's over, Neil. It's all over. It's, and I'm like, what are you talking about? We're giving away masters. CDs is giving away masters. And then Napster and all that started to happen. He goes, I'm looking for my exit plan. You know, he's throwing this Nerf ball. What do you want? I said, well, here's my idea. And he goes, yeah, great idea. Do it. You know what I mean? And I'm going, walk out of there. I think that was good because we do get to go around the world to make a video, but he did say it's all over. So I'm not sure what that means.
Comforting words from the record company president.
Yeah. But it's true. Your CD was, you basically, I mean, the quality at that time wasn't as good as it is today, but you're giving away masters where, you know, you could, through the internet, send copies, right?
Let's take a bit of a break before we pick things up with 5440 in the digital age. After a couple of decades working in the traditional recorded music business, 5440, along with thousands of other bands, had to adapt to the new realities of the digital world. Here's what they did. So now we enter a period of time where, well, how would you describe the 2000s for you?
Foggy?
Well, I remember having another existential conversation.
This
with
is
Neil.
Number three, in case anybody's counting.
Yeah. So, and this is because all the stuff's happening where we're seeing all of our friends being escorted out of record companies with, you know, boxes of files and their stapler and whatever else. And you could see the whole music business changing, and you didn't understand what's coming next. And we were over here at Nathan Phillips Square, and we sat down just in front of City Hall here in Toronto. And it's like, because that was another point where we could say, yeah, well, we could just pack it in now and find something else to do, or how are we going to sort of move forward? And what we determined between the two of us is we were actually in a pretty good place because we had, you know, this body of work which came up through the old system, and so we could actually still go and do things on that, and then we'll sort of figure out how this whole digital world works and how it applies to us in the future as we go. So we had this sort of transition period where we were figuring things out.
What sort of ownership did you have over your music?
So we had all of our publishing from before Sony. So we owned all that. We had masters before. Maybe we had given away our masters to, I can't remember, but anyway. And then we had given away, everyone else had the masters that count, and the publishing, all the Sony publishing was owned by, all the songs we recorded with Sony, they published. I don't know.
They own the masters, yeah, and they own,
yeah,
half the publishing. Yeah. We got paid handsomely.
In 2003, 5440 was back to being an indie band after 20 years. The first record under those new conditions was called Goodbye Flatland. And from that album is Take Me Out.
Take me out of this life. Take me out of this hole. Take me out. Take me out tonight.
Take Me Out from the 2003 5440 album Goodbye Flatland. And since that record, everything the band has released has been on an indie label. That was followed by Yes to Everything in 2005, which came out on True North Records. True North also released Northern Soul in 2008.
So after Northern Soul, things start to, the output starts to go down. So it's not an album every 2 years anymore. There's Lost in the City, and there's the big gap to keep on walking. Was there, what was the thinking behind this?
There was something in between there.
Yeah, there was the live unplugged record.
There was Northern Soul too.
Yeah, you mentioned Northern Soul.
Oh, yeah. We did.
Oh, and then Lost in the City.
Yeah.
And then before Keep on Walking, there was also an unplugged record, La Difference.
Yeah. So, what's this one with Easy to Love?
Easy to Love is on Yes to Everything.
Yes to Everything. Yeah. So that was the last sort of FM radio top 10 we had in Canada. That was a Dave riff, by the way. And then, yeah, so we noticed things were changing. You know, you get told, like, yeah, Much Music isn't going to play you. They're throwing you over to Much Light or whatever the hell it was called. Don't worry, Blue Rodeo's there too. You know, that kind of thing. It's like, what? You know, we're not cool anymore? You know? And all these other things, right? Like, all our generation of bands are being moved over. And it's like, oh, that's interesting.
In 2023, there will be two new releases, one live album recorded at the El Macambo in Toronto, and another written during COVID called West Coast Band. We'll get to something from that in just a second, but first...
All right, COVID, what do you do during those awful years?
Well, interestingly enough, Brad came up with the idea of, doing a Zoom call. So we got on, and this became the impetus, which is for the record that's going to come out next, because we started telling stories and, you know, fun and funny stuff about our history and just telling, you know, first it's grumpy old men, right? Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, like, how's your hip? You know, how's your knees? Da, 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 all that sort of stuff. How you hanging in there, man? Because we don't live all in the same place, right? We, three of us live on islands and Dave's in Vancouver. So we just started to tell stories, and, you know, we all have monikers like Matt, the drummer's table for one, because that's the way he likes to operate. Like, gets in the van, immediately puts on his headphones. And there's a story behind Table for One where we were doing a gig. Where was it? Thunder Bay or something like that?
Thunder Bay or North Bay. Yeah.
And we did sound check, and we had to rush over back to the motel, quickly shower, eat, and get back to the gig. And Matt decides he's not going to want to shower. He's just going to go to the Canadian Chinese buffet that's right beside the motel in North Bay. You know the one. And and there's a lineup. And so we get out of the shower. We're all dressed, gig ready. And Matt's at the front of the line. And we go right to the buffet, fill our plate, say, Matt, get a table for four. And he's so pissed off because he had to wait. And she goes, how many? He goes, table for one. So we had to go back to the line.
Well, there was like probably 20 people in line, and they just walked right in front of everyone. I was horrified. I was like, oh my God, they're just ignored the lineup, the queue, you know? So I was like, I think it was Neil or Brad kind of waved at me, get a table for four. And I went, I just shook my head and went, nope.
And we have a tradition since Dave joined the band where we have this drink that Dave makes for us called Vodka Surprise. So it's
that doesn't sound good.
Yeah, it's not. Well, it is actually. Every day is the best one ever.
Well, I'm feeling the surprise this morning.
Yeah. So we have a song named after that, and Dave making us the drink. And then when Dave first joined the band, we were on the road, and he didn't quite understand Brad's vibe and personality. And he turned to me and go, "Where did you find that guy?" And so there's a song about Brad. It's called "Hey Brad," but it's, you know, where did you find that guy? And we have a song called "Food Loser," which everybody can relate to. This is when you're out dining with a group of people and somebody's order gets wrong or it doesn't come or it's cold. We have another song called "Same Guy, Different Body," which is that drunk person that somehow worms their way into the dressing room and is all brave and you can't get rid of them. And then they get all dark and want to fight you because they're not that drunk that they know you don't like them. That happens a lot. We have another song called "Options," which is a story of when we were playing in Regina at the same time as Blue Rodeo, and Keeler came over to check out our set and was in the dressing room. And I said to him, this is like 15, 20 years ago. He's like, "Hey, Neil, how's it going?" I go, "Oh, you know, pretty good." And I said, you know, Greg, I don't think I could do anything else. Like if I had to stop this being a musician thing, I don't think I could do anything else. And he goes, "Nice to know your options are behind you." But it's true. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. You don't have to worry. So we have that song about that story. So there's all the songs on the new record are stories of the band and things that have happened in the band. So it's quite fun.
Man, oh man, we've seen it before. A really drunk guy who cannot score. Let me introduce you to same guy, different body.
After being together for so long, there must be a road story. The crazy thing that you cannot believe happened to you while you were touring.
There's lots of them. There was a time where we were at a Tower Records convention in Sacramento. Our bus pulled up there and we're hanging out there, and it's you know, free drinks, obviously, and we're drinking this great, you know, California Chardonnay, and everyone's feeling good. And then we get back on the bus after the end of this thing, and we're rolling down the street, and there's a little jump seat in the front, and so our lighting guy sits down the jump seat, and he kind of misses the jump seat, and the bus is going at a pretty good rate here. He hits the door handle on the way out and then rolls out the bus, and we're literally, you know, 100 meters before we're able to stop. So that was, it wasn't funny at the moment, but when he rolled around and got up and said, "I'm okay," it was pretty funny.
Yeah. I mean, highlights of the band was, I mean, without getting too long, you know, but just quickly, maybe another time we can get into it, would be our trip to Moscow. We were there for a week in an exchange thing while Gorbachev was still the head of, we saw the last May Day parade, the last communist May Day parade. We did a show there with a band called the Scramblers, you know, who ended up getting in jail and stuff like that. But once they said the word Gretzky, they got let out of jail. Hanging out with Ronnie Wood for a night was legendary, even at his age.
Meeting Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris and
yeah.
Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah.
That was thrilling.
And then, yeah, just like I said, same guy, different body. We did a show in St. Catharines where it was a woman who worked her way into the dressing room and, you know, started to be really annoying and, you know, sit on my lap and "I like you" and all that. And then I sort of indicated to the bouncer, like, "Can you get rid of her, please?" And so he tried, and she went off and hauled and broke his nose. And she was tough. So it took three bouncers to get her out. That was memorable for me anyways. Like, holy shit.
One more comment from 5440. Well, there does come a time, you know, when somebody makes a choice for you. Are you new alternative modern rock, or are you classic rock?
Yeah.
Are you adult hits?
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the greatest experiences was just before COVID in the summer, where we played two different festivals one on a, I think a Saturday or Sunday or Friday and a Saturday. So when we were a new band in the classic rock, we played with Boston and REO Speedwagon. So we finally graduated to classic rock. Right. And then the next day we were sort of in the middle slot of with Winter Sleep and all these, I don't even know the names of these bands, the super cool bands. And I was like, that is great. We're in both camps. This is the best day ever. Yeah. Best weekend.
Friday,
ever.
We were the youngest band on the bill and Saturday we were the oldest band in the bill.
Thanks again to Neil, Brad, Matt, and Dave from 5440 for carving out some time to tell their story. And thanks to Alan Moy from their management team for helping arrange things. There's a lot more of that interview that we didn't have time for in these two radio shows, but the good news is that the podcast versions include pretty much the entire conversation from the Horseshoe. Get them wherever you download podcasts. Plus, you'll find more from the In Their Own Words series, along with hundreds of others ongoing history episodes. Please binge. My website is ajournalofmusicalthings.com. Get the free daily newsletter. And if you want to reach me directly, use alan@alancross.ca. Technical productions by Rob Johnston. I'm Alan Cross.
You've been listening to the Ongoing History of New Music podcast with Alan Cross. Subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.